This week on Education Radio.
We are doing things now people would never have dreamed of 5 years ago in terms of relationships between test scores and evaluation and charter schools and CAPS and really discussions about what it means to be an educated student.
The market forces are not interested in the generation of new knowledge. They're interested in the generation of capital.
They will tell you straight up. There are like 25% of kids who they believe will never amount to anything. So why should they spend money and energy educating them? But you can't say that out loud.
Welcome to Education Radio. I'm Barbara Madalone.
And I'm Tim Scott. Education Radio is committed to exposing the underlying story behind the assault on public education. This assault starts with funding cuts for public schools and colleges, is followed by attacks on teachers and low-income students and parents, and finishes with pillaging and profiteering of the now devalued public commodity by private corporations. These corporations go on to manage schools, write curriculum, test students, test teachers, teach teachers, and collect endless reams of data points on the behaviors of teachers and students to basically take over the education of our children. A large part of the success of this profiteering is due to the ability of neoliberal discourse to infiltrate our very ideas of what it means to teach, know, and learn. Thus, policy and pundit conversations about education draw from economic models like value-added and talk about student learning as data points and outcomes. Knowledge is dynamic and connected to values and choices we make as citizens in a democracy is smothered. Instead, we get knowledge that is viewed as a commodity that is standardized and measured as a product or outcome. It is devoid of human interactions, creativity, and democratic power that knowledge for critical learning can be.
For classroom teachers and principals, the demand for value-added measures imposed by race to the top is poisoning the very fabric of our work, of the relationships that make a school cohere. For teacher educators, the attack on colleges of education, imposition of standardized teacher assessments, and the decoupling of teacher education from higher education similarly denies us our knowledge and the human relationships upon which all learning is grounded. As educators, we struggle daily with how to name these processes and to decide what actions and risks we can and must take to fight back. In this two-part episode of Education Radio, we ask, what is driving the accountability culture in teaching and teacher education? Who is profiting from the imposition of these measures? What has allowed the neoliberal discourse to infiltrate education from K-16 to teacher education? What do we lose when we find ourselves in this neoliberal horror show? And how do we fight back? In a series of interviews with teacher educators, administrators, and union leaders, we examine how audit culture is restructuring K-12 education and teacher education, and restricting the possibilities for how we understand what it means to learn, know, and teach in a democracy. Beyond naming what is happening, we spoke with educators who are using their voices, connecting in solidarity, and fighting back.
We start in Old Westbury, New York, where Principal Sean Feeney has been a leader in speaking out against the implementation of the new value-added teacher evaluation system in response to New York State being awarded Race to the Top monies. As Feeney makes clear in this interview, Race to the Top is a structural adjustment policy which exploited the economic crisis to blackmail state departments of education to accept the dubious value-added teacher evaluation systems and deepened the imposition of testing culture and canned curriculum in schools. Education Radio producer Barbara Madaloni sat down with Dr. Feeney to talk with him about a letter he and a colleague wrote to the New York State Board of Regents objecting to the value-added measures, to the process by which they are imposed, and the impact they would have on teaching and learning. Known as the New York Principal's Annual Performance Review Letter, this act of speaking back has garnered signatures from more than 70% of principals on Long Island and almost 30% statewide. Here is Dr. Feeney.
The time of tremendous change in the world of education, and I think certainly Race to the Top as a piece of legislation, whatever you want to call it, has been one of the most significant pieces in terms of bang for the buck that I've seen in my many years following politics. It has not been a lot of money, but it has created tremendous change in the world of education. And We are doing things now that people would never have dreamed of 5 years ago in terms of relationships between schools and teachers and students and teachers and test scores and evaluation and charter schools and CAPS and really discussions about what it means to be an educated student. And it's been dramatic. And a big part of that, of course, is the money was dangled out there for folks in the middle of one of the most significant economic downturns in our generation. As someone who's been in education for over 22 years, you know, to follow all the changes, you look and you follow and you want to make sure that, you know, those things that are being done are being done thoughtfully. They are being done based on research, based on good practices. As New York rushed through its application, and it was rushed. I mean, it was rushed, and basically changed significantly their teacher evaluation system. It became clear that they're just throwing everything in there to go after this money without any real thought and certainly without any collaboration. So, you know, New York State in May of 2010 signed off with the teachers union, NYSET, basically signed off on this new way of evaluating teachers, which was a crucial aspect of their Race to the Top application. They had to work on charter schools, and they had to work on getting a consensus among districts, but that was the big piece. So this linkage of student test scores to teacher evaluation in a very direct way occurred in May 2010. That was approved, signed off by the teachers. They also had expedited 3020A hearings, which were, you know, the hearings to remove ineffective teachers. So it was really notable here in New York, because prior to that, certainly I've used test scores to evaluate teachers all the time. I know the test scores of every one of my teachers by their kids. I can break it down by gender, ethnicity, whether it's a region score, our state test, the 3-8 test, whether it's an AP score, whatever it might be. I've always looked at test scores. But now the requirement is that not only do you look at them, but the teacher's evaluation has to include this, and it will count for this much. So it was a very prescribed formula. So they do that, and they go through and they develop, ostensibly they had committees, and they had representatives from the different groups in New York State coming together once a month or once every month to discuss different aspects of APPR. That happened from about October of 2010 through April of 2011. In April of 2011, they submit their draft plan. Okay, so it was approved in May 2010. In April 2011, we get to see it, mid-April. It's voted on by the regents in May of 2011 to be implemented for the 11-12 school year, partially, fully for the 12-13. We have teachers right now who are being implemented by a plan that was finalized in April, signed off on in May, and they still have so many unanswered questions, and that's been one of the biggest criticisms we've had. This is a plan that was rushed, is not research-based. There are a few other things that are happening. They're trying to change graduation standards, and we prepared a paper on graduation standards that was really a thoughtful paper, and we presented it to the commissioner. We presented it to our regents, the local governing body, the state governing body. We sort of worked within the system. There were some other changes and continued to work within the system. We weren't really seeing any effect. So then a decision was made late last year to cancel the regents exams, primarily given in June, but also given in January. So kids who struggle in June have a chance to retake them in January rather than waiting an entire year. And it was, you know, enough is enough. How can you just cancel these exams? So I said, you know what? The time has passed for working within the system. They're not listening. They're doing what they want to do. There's no consultation. With a stroke of a pen, they eliminated the January exams. They didn't really ask what would the implications be. So I wrote an open letter. I had principals sign off, and I just focused on high school principals at the time, and I got 72 high school principals over the course of 1 or 2 days to sign off on this letter. I then submitted the letter to media. I submitted it to the regents, to SED officials, and heard nothing from anyone until Newsday called Now, Newsday is our largest newspaper here in Long Island, and they put that story on the front page in June of last year. It got great coverage. It was a favorable story. I was interviewed for it, but the focus was on principal slam the tests, the cancellation of tests, principal slam this, we slam that, they like that line. But it got the attention of folks, and that was in June, and I was down in Florida at the end of July. I got a call from the reporter. They were installed again, so the Regents exams were back. Became clear this was a strategy, getting outside folks to understand what was happening. So as I saw my frustrations with APPR, which is this legislation that was passed, and I saw how it was being just so poorly implemented, it wasn't research-based. The video they showed at the training, have you heard about this video?
No.
The APPR legislation required that anyone who was evaluating folks get trained. So I needed 10 days of training. And on that first day, they showed a video. And the video was of a plane being built in the air. And they're flying, we're building the plane in the air! And you see like luggage flying out, and seats flying out, but we're building, this is so exciting, it's invigorating. Now the only people that have parachutes are the pilot and one of the crew members. Nobody else has a parachute. And what an apt metaphor. And somehow they thought that was appropriate for the training, that people would chuckle. So we have this new system that has, really, is a bad system, but has serious implications for the livelihood of teachers and students. And we're using a plane flying in the air metaphor for our training. It just really spoke to me how these folks really don't know what this sounds like or looks like. So Carol Burrs, who is another principal, she's principal of Southside in Rockville Center, we were bantering back and forth, and we started contacting each other more. I mean, we've been colleagues and friendly, but during the march, the SOS march that was held in D.C., we both attended that, and we did some outreach leading into it to get the word out. So I got to know Carol, and then Carol and I were complaining about this, and the commissioner was set to visit Long Island for a big conference, and we said, well, we should present him with our concerns. And we met, we grabbed a few other principals, and I already saw the outline of my concerns, and I grouped them into three primary concerns. I also learned, with the other letter I wrote, you got to keep the language simple. And you got to help people understand what it means. So using those as guides, and I had that contact now with Newsday, I said, why don't we write an open letter again? Let's get signatures and let's put something together. So Carol and I drafted a letter, really collaborated on it and pushed it out, and then we showed it to a bunch of principals here in Nassau County, and they provided some commentary and feedback. It was an iterative process, so we just kept doing more drafts and more drafts. And I then shared it with the executive boards of elementary schools, middle schools across Long Island. And, the strategy was developed to really call this a Long Island principal's letter. Get the support of the Long Island principals. Regionally, it was easy to do because we know the area. I was known because I just know folks from the other executive boards, so we thought that would be easy. So we started getting signatories from other Long Island districts, and we tracked it. And our goal was to get 50% of the principals and then have Newsday run the story. So I contacted the Newsday reporter. She was very happy to meet with us. So on Thursday, November 3rd, they ran the story. We had, at the time, I think 53% of the principals. This is principals in elementary, middle, and high school. So in a matter of a few weeks, Carol and I were the first signatories on October 23rd. So from October 23rd to November 3rd, we got half of the principals in Long Island. And they ran a big cover story. And that's the cover story. That's a big cover story.
That's a big cover story and a very powerful picture.
Right. You look angry.
You look angry and determined.
So Carol is in the front. Mm-hmm. That's me. And these are other principals who, you know, represent a good cross-section of of the Long Island schools.
Long Island principals rebel.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm hardly a rebel, but what I am is someone who believes in education and believes in our system, believes in the value of public schools, and is deeply concerned about what he sees. A strong movement, there's this thread and this trend. Most of the experience at SED right now is with charter schools. Listen, I'm not opposed to charter schools in themselves, but let us not lose sight that we are public schools, and charter schools are different than public schools. There's a lot of outside, deep-pocketed funds right now that are supporting these initiatives, and our voice is getting lost. We are the practitioners. You know, just that cover page, you're looking at, you know, hundreds of years of experience, not just in schools, but in organizations, you know, local, regional, national presence. And my line was always, this is, with APPR, this is bad practice. And I refuse to just stand by and watch this train wreck. And I really felt strongly that if I didn't do something, I'd be upset with myself.
This is Education Radio, and we've been listening to Sean Feeney, principal from Long Island, New York, as he discusses his decision, along with colleagues, to speak out publicly against the imposition of value-added measures as a response to the manufactured crisis of race to the top. In this next section, Feeney talks with Education Radio producer Barbara Madaloni about the business model that is corrupting education and the distortion of public policy through the selling of a common sense but simplistic understanding of teaching and learning, while using measures of teacher effectiveness that are invalid and unreliable.
We have a lot of folks who are standing up and deciding that they know how to fix schools. And when the mayor of New York City can stand up and tell an audience at MIT that, you know, the best way to fix schools is to fire half the teachers, double class size. Well, all due respect, Mayor Bloomberg, you know. Really? That's based on what? Your personal view? Your whim? Where's the research that this is based on? You know, educational research. There is research, and, you know, it doesn't always point exactly in the same direction, but there's enough consistency. We actually have a good sense of what good practices are for most areas, and if we don't, we know what we need to do to find those out. This sense that you're going to fire half the teachers, and this is a model. His statement of firing half the teachers is a direct outgrowth of the foundation of their model and their application for Race to the Top, because the state has said that they will have and they will give scores to teachers based on a bell curve. That means you will expect 50% of your teachers to be in the bottom. There are four bands, bottom four, bottom two levels, 50% in the upper two. So right away you're saying 50% will be developing or failing. They're saying that without any data. And with Mayor Bloomberg's model, let's suppose you fire half the teachers. Well, how are you going to identify that half? Well, you've got them from the student test scores, clearly. So those, you fire those right away. Well, according to their model, the bell curve remains unchanged. So then you have the same bell curve, new population under, and you still have 50% who can be identified as failing or developing. There's no skewing in the bell curve. You would think in a district setting, listen, I'm blessed to work in a wonderful district. You know, we're not desperate for teachers. People want to work here. So we've got resources, lovely. You would think that we'd be able to have more effective teachers than, you know, a district in a poor, struggling area, but not according to the state's model.
So what's your understanding of what's driving that? I mean, the absurdity is so evident.
It is.
And yet it's a very powerful force.
Well, it is a belief that, you know, student test scores, it's a business model.
Say more about that.
Students are our product. Because this, and we write about this in the letter, at first blush, at first glance, the public gets it. Yeah, that seems to make sense, yeah. Well, of course, teachers should be held accountable for student test scores. Yeah, because, you know, how students do, that's directly related to how the teacher is. And bad teachers I mean, students get bad scores. I mean, that's the sensibility they have sold to the public, and they've sold it quite effectively. But once you start talking a little more about what happens in schools, and the fact, and I say this to the faculty every year, a student's success or failure does not rest on your shoulders alone. And, you know, listen, Johnny might get a 95 on that math test at the end of the year. Did Johnny have a tutor? Did Johnny have a crisis in school that was then helped, you know, where a psychologist or the guidance counselor helped him through? Maybe Johnny had, you know, hated school, didn't want to go to any extra help, but the coach said, you're not playing on this team unless you go and you get your score. You know, there are a lot of folks who were involved. You know, did he receive physical therapy? Did he do X, Y, Z? So this thought that that 95 is the sole property, if you will, of that math teacher, I think it's misleading, and it doesn't speak to what we know about and all the research, Marzano, the four, Reeves, what they know about what works in schools, the sense of working together as a community. So they're presenting a situation that is not based in the reality of schools. But it does have an appeal at first glance. But once you delve down, because every parent has a kid who has had a crisis, every parent has a kid who might have needed extra support in a classroom and recognize, oh, yeah, boy, you know, had it not been for Ms. So-and-so, my kid would have failed this other subject. You know, they get it. But, you know, so it's a little, this kind of deception going on. And maybe not deception's a little strong, but an omission of the true picture of what goes on in a school. You know, the other issue is the use of the model. Now, we test here in New York, we use, and even in Massachusetts, the MCAS was developed, for example, to measure student understanding of the curriculum. Right? I mean, that's, and in our Regents exams, if you look at the description of it, says very clearly Regents exams were designed to measure student understanding of the curriculum. Okay? So anyone who knows anything about instruments and measurement, every instrument is designed to measure a specific thing. You can't use that instrument to measure something else. So now an instrument developed to measure student understanding of the curriculum is being used to measure teacher effectiveness. You know, you can't do that. I mean, that just, there's no validity or reliability. There might be, but have we done any tests on it? Have we examined the validity and reliability of that? If I have a meter stick, could I figure out somebody's weight? I guess I could. You take a lot of different measures and cross-sections and figure you could probably come up with that person's weight, but is that how you want to do it, and is that going to be something that you will consistently be able to use to get an accurate measure of that person's weight? No, meter sticks are for height. Scales are for weight. Different tools to measure different things. So here in New York, we're forging ahead with the same tool designed to measure student understanding, to measure teacher effectiveness. Anyone with a background in measurement recognizes that's problematic.
This is Education Radio, and we are talking with Long Island Principal Sean Feeney as he discusses the dangers of value-added teacher evaluation systems and the ease with which policymakers, such as Merrill Tisch, Chancellor of the Board of Regents, participate in a discourse that devalues teachers.
They will paint teachers as being the obstacle. Teachers' unions especially, that it's their fault that schools won't improve because all they do is protect their members. I mean, this is the argument. I've worked in six different buildings, in six different districts. I've had great relationships with the teachers' union. My experience with teachers' unions have always been they want nothing but the best members. And if an administrator is administrating appropriately, following due process and being fair, you know, and you, if you will, squeeze a teacher, okay, as long as you respect the process. So I've had great relations with teachers' unions. I have hardly found them to be problems. They are usually wonderful partners. And even when we see differently, you know, it's helpful. It's helpful. So you want that, and you want a good, strong partner. But that's not the universal view. And I think in many ways this is an attempt to probably break unions, the strength of unions, and make sure that, you know, they're probably somewhat devalued. I mean, our own chancellor. So ostensibly the head of our school system in New York State. When that New York Times article came out, I mean, her quote was, now that we have sum and substance, now that we have these scientific measures, I have the paper here. This was just astounding to hear the head of the Regents. Merrill Tisch, Chancellor of the Board of Regents, said that because of the new, quote, scientific objective evaluation system, this is not scientific or objective, because a scientific objective measure you'd be able to repeat from one year to the next. And what we have found, what research has found with especially the value added, is they are not repeatable. And this is of great concern. But I continue with the quote. Because of the new scientific objective evaluation system, the public would see that teachers were being held to a rigorous standard and would not dislike them so much. That, to me, is astounding. The public will not dislike teachers so much. I mean, they'll probably still dislike them, of course, but just not so much. For me, that sort of mentality is astounding. And, there's some resentment for teachers. I mean, Mayor Bloomberg's going to fire half of the teachers? Really?
Trust in me, in all you do. Have the faith I have in you. Love will see us through if only you trust in me. Why don't you trust me?
Welcome back to Education Radio. I'm Tim Scott.
And I'm Barbara Mattaloni. In today's program, we are examining the imposition of value-added teacher evaluation systems through Race to the Top, the neoliberal agenda driving this audit culture, and the pushback against these measures. We've been talking to Sean Feeney, Long Island principal, who has taken a public stand against the new teacher evaluation systems and encouraged others to join him. Through the details of what is happening in New York State, we see the degree to which the discourse of capital, the market, and economics has infiltrated education and is part of the common sense that keeps many from seeing the destructiveness of these forces. But as Sean Feeney helps us see, this discourse and these policies are destructive of the very fabric of teaching and learning.
In producing these shows, we found a clear link between canned curriculum in public schools, the infiltration of teacher education by standardized assessments, the use of high-stakes testing to evaluate teachers, and the awarding of no-bid contracts to manage student data. That link is the corporate money undoing education as liberation and transformation, and reforming it to vocational work in the service of global capital. We spoke with Celia Euler, Associate Professor of Education at Teachers College, Columbia University, about the impact of market forces on teacher education and K-12 education. Listen as she helps us understand just how pervasive the market forces are that control education reform. She brings us into the details of the awarding of a no-bid contract by the New York State Board of Regents to Wireless Generation, owned by Rupert Murdoch, funded by Bill Gates, and with links to former New York City Chancellor of Education, Joel Klein.
The market forces are not interested in the generation of new knowledge. They're interested in the generation of capital, right? So the Gates fact sheet that talks about the Wireless Generation contract talks about the support a large market, this is their words, they will support a large market for vendors of learning materials and application developers to deliver content and tools that meet the Common Core State Standards. So that's a whole different approach to what it is to be educated, what it means to be a teacher.
Can you talk about this Wireless Generation and how that decision came down, because that's really important?
Well, I was actually really surprised by it. The article circulated from the Wall Street Journal just this, last week.
Yeah.
And my major source of a lot of information in various blogs like Gotham Schools and New York City Public Schools Parents Blog. And so the New York City Public School Parents Blog has an article with a headline. I'll just read it to you. It's, Regents agree to give New York State data to corporation run by Gates and operated by Murdoch's Wireless Generation. And the reason I was so surprised by this is that there had been a no-bid contract given to Wireless Generation. And I don't know if you know, Wireless Generation is the company that Joel Klein, who used to be the New York City Chancellor of Education, he went to go work at Wireless, and Wireless is owned by Murdoch. So Wireless, right away when Joel Klein went there, was given this no-bid contract. It was, you know, some kind of $44 million something contract to do these data platforms that are required as part of the state's applications for Race to the Top. You had to have a system of doing the data compilation and analysis. And when they talk about data, they're really not talking about anything other than standardized test scores, right? That's really the data that these people are always talking about. When they talk about achievement, it's not learning. It's always reduced to standardized test scores. So the no-bid contract was actually shut down in New York State. It was vetoed by the comptroller's office at the state level. And so then somehow they were able to turn around and get this private deal from Gates to give Wireless even more money to include all of these states in this multi-state, what they're calling a shared learning collaborative, and it's a consortium of states. And it mystifies me, actually, how agile these business people are at crafting the states and the federal money. So state money, federal money is going directly into these companies, and they don't even pretend that it's not about making money, right? So they're helping that, quoting here on the public school parents blog from the Gates fact sheet, in addition to making instructional data more manageable and useful, this open license technology, provisionally called the shared learning infrastructure, will also support a large market for vendors of learning materials. So there's this assumption in there that there's a relationship between the achievement test scores that are going to be aggregated in these, you know, databases, and that it ties somehow to instruction, right? Because they call it instructional data. But it's not instructional data because there's very little relationship between the assessments and actual instruction. So in terms of time lag and also in terms of the fineness of grained information that you actually need to design instruction for the next week and for the next month, right, for your students. So all of this is not good science, not good math, and certainly has very little to do with improving instruction, but there's a lot of money to be made. So I am mystified that we're able to get, like, all the Board of Regents to be able to go along and agree to this contract. There was one abstention. One woman on the New York State Board of Regents abstained. And so I really am baffled at how easily they are able to pull off these large venture capital businesses at taxpayers' expense.
Well, I part of my thought about that is a famous piece by Joanne Weiss, who's undersecretary to Arne Duncan in the Harvard Business Review from, I guess it would be about a year, year and a half ago, talking about the National Educational Technology Plan and how exciting it was because of the opportunities for vendors to participate in that. So this, I mean, it's coming from the Secretary of Education saying, you know, his undersecretary saying, this is what this is about. I mean, it's just how deeply this discourse of the market is a part of how things happen that I don't even know when I saw that vote from the Regents. Like, is there anybody on the Regents who wonders about the market as the primary moving force in how we proceed in life? Or is it just that deeply naturalized, or is it worse than that because they're in somebody's pocket?
I think there's a little bit of the lots of deals made behind closed doors, business as usual kind of attitude. Certainly we saw that with the Pearson contract and David Steiner, who used to be the commissioner of education for New York State. And he went at Pearson Foundation expense on an all-expense paid with a lot of other people to London, and then a few weeks later turned around and gave the Pearson for-profit corporation a big contract. So certainly there is some of that. And who knows, I don't know who these Board of Regents people are. I do know that their advisors are what they're calling these Regents Fellows. And they're paid for by Meryl Tisch's own money. She put up $1 million to pay for these Regents Fellows who supposedly do research. And their findings always seem to point to the things that the Board of Regents were going to do anyway. So, I mean, there is some of this kind of money can buy some data and some findings, and it's all in the guise of greater accountability and greater effectiveness. Certainly they wrap it in that rhetoric. But at the end of the day, they're not even embarrassed to show that it really is about making money, that there's these markets that are going to be open to vendors, right? That they're fairly shameless about it, that it is about market. So I think they acknowledge that it's about market, and I think that they, the people who are behind these kinds of movements, you know, wireless generation, K-12, Pearson, these value-added scores for teachers, increasing the use of accountability measures, they're fully aware that these are market-driven reforms, and they think that's appropriate because a lot of them are from business backgrounds, right? That's what they have in common, is they actually don't come from education. They haven't been classroom teachers. They haven't worked in schools. They certainly haven't worked in low-income community schools. And so their basis of understanding how the world works is through business. So they think that if you can just apply good business procedures, then it'll help schools get better, is the rhetoric, right? So you're going to analyze what you can analyze. So what can you analyze in a business? You can analyze how much your expenses are for personnel. You can analyze, you know, what the market is looking for. And then you can analyze how much it costs you to produce each unit of whatever it is you're producing. And the problem is, of course, human experience doesn't reduce to those small little quantifiable pieces. So it doesn't work. So they've taken on an entire market approach to try to improve schools. It won't work. It can't work. And teachers know it can't work. And I do think there is a growing awareness among teachers and parents and communities about the limits of the accountability talk and about the market-driven reform talk. I think people are really starting to talk back to it.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways it feels like they've potentially overreached, not only in terms of public schools, but in terms of their efforts to privatize everything. You know, I mean, that is the neoliberal ideology, is that the market will rule. So I do get a little bit hopeful about that possibility. I was looking in terms of the connections between these forces. You know, Pearson Inc., they purchased America's Choice.
Mm-hmm.
America's Choice was part of the development of the Relay Graduate School of Education. Pearson then, and America's Choice then also, is producing the so-called instructional materials for Common Core because they're funded by Bill Gates.
This is Education Radio. I'm Tim Scott.
I'm Barbara Mattalone. We've just been speaking with Celia Euler, Professor of Education at Teachers College, Columbia University, about the depth and breadth of the corporate power and profiteering behind the so-called education reform movement. We now go to Chicago, where we speak with Karen Lewis, head of the Chicago Teachers Union, as she helps to unpack the historical context of philanthropic education reform as a means to control poor people, people of color, and the working class. Karen Lewis's discussion of the intersection of poverty, race, and class in education reform is critical to understanding how the new common sense of education reform builds upon implicit and long-standing racist and classist assumptions and ideologies. As we have heard as well from Sean Feeney and Celia Euler, the newest manifestation of these control mechanisms are decidedly undemocratic. Here is Karen Lewis.
These kinds of reforms have been going on since we've had public education. Public education, and especially for minority children, has actually been influenced very seriously by philanthropic efforts from the colonial times. I mean, so this is not new. I mean, if you look back at how these business folks and these, you know, you look back at the Rockefellers and the Carnegie Mellon folks, and you just look all back and the people that developed Hampton Institute and whatever, and you're going to see this, you know, Russell Sage, for example, you're going to see this intersection of philanthropy and politics and education policy, all geared towards, you know, pigeonholing and putting minority children and poor children in certain pathways. So the issue now is that we keep talking about everybody needs a college education, but we also know that if you give everybody a college education, where are the jobs? I mean, people are graduating from college now, but there's no place for them to go. So we have a lot of just infinitely fluid pathways. So you're saying, how do we connect the dots? The dots are connected primarily because the people who are making education policy have an agenda right now. And it's very simple. That agenda is, they're very clear that there's some serious problems in urban education, in rural education, but anywhere where we're talking about educating poor children. And the best way to deal with that is to throw the least amount of money at it. Okay, so how do you do that? Well, you have to decrease the amount you pay staffing. So once you decrease the amount you pay staff, then there's more money to go around to do these other things, which is primarily give money to consultants and vendors and blah, 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 so that, you know, the people that are actually doing the work are starting to become less and less important and their voice is less important. I mean, I think the whole thing is that there's a lot of lip service to who gets educated. But if you listen, and if the people who make policy get to talk honestly, they will tell you straight up. There are like 25% of kids who they believe will never amount to anything. So why should they spend money and energy educating them? But you can't say that out loud. You cannot say that in polite company. So they say politically, well, we want to educate all children. Where not only do they not want to do it, they have no intention of doing it, but they do have intention of using those children as props for them to do their own dirty work, which is to undermine the benefits and the salaries that teachers have and paraprofessionals have earned that have taken them into the middle class. And especially if you look at urban areas where you see an increase in the number of teachers of color, up until just recently, we're now seeing a huge decline in Chicago, for example, in the number of teachers of color. So what we are now pushing is this myth of the outsider who has all this brilliant knowledge that they can bestow upon poor children and children of color, and especially trying to push a sort of middle-class aspirational life that teaches them, quote-unquote, discipline. So what we see now is very narrowed curriculum that's totally tailored to passing the test, but also, not only do you have a narrow curriculum, you also have a very narrow zero-tolerance behavior code. These are the kinds of things that lead us to believe that certain children are allowed freedom of thought and expression, other children are not.
This is Education Radio. I'm Tim Scott. As Karen Lewis makes clear, the big story behind education reform is that those who support it pretend to be concerned about poor children and social justice, but never talk or do anything about poverty, and instead impose canned and biased curriculum, high-stakes testing, and demands for annual yearly progress that actually work to limit opportunities and resources for the poor, working class, and children of color. While much of the assault on public education attacks teachers and their unions for being recalcitrant and responsible for the manufactured crisis of schools, teachers have actually been doggedly trying to meet the demands of reformers. In this next section, Karen Lewis helps us understand how under the last 30 to 40 years of neoliberal reforms, teachers have come to understand that the goal is not reform, but union busting and privatization.
So the problem is, we have been reformed over and over and over again for the last 30 years. We've had this sense of urgency about everything. And the key is, as teachers and as paraprofessionals, we have responded to every single thing they've asked us to do. You need to get a master's degree. So everybody went and got master's degrees. Then they said, you need to get all these special endorsements. So everybody's gotten special endorsements. Then they say you have to do nationally board certified. So people are going to do that. So every single time they put out something that says this will change teacher quality, this is going to make a difference, and teachers go do it. And then there's another study 5 minutes later that says, well, this doesn't work. So the problem is, as professionals, we feel like we're constantly running behind these people, trying to keep up, trying to do the right thing, and yet we have had absolutely nothing but been bashed for the last 30, 40 years. And people are now exhausted and more resistant, and especially to this whole idea of tying standardized test scores to your evaluation, when we know how much variance there is in value added, which is not even an educational tool. As you know, it's an economic tool. It's a tool out of economics. And to also have this lack of preparation, this lack of explanation, this lack of training, and a complete hit or miss on professional development. So, you know, it's kind of like you're going to abuse me again, and yet if you gave me the roadmap, I'd be willing to follow it. So I think we're suffering from reform fatigue, quite frankly. And this particular type of reform is much more vicious and much more dangerous because it is so well funded by extraordinarily wealthy people.
In today's show, we've examined the ways that neoliberal reformers have hijacked the discourse or common sense of teaching and learning to impose a market model on education. Using the language of reform, they have shifted the discussion of what it means to learn, to teach, and to educate, all in the interest of privatization and profit-making. One of the critical elements of this shift is the degree to which it marginalizes other possibilities for thinking about and enacting teaching and learning. Activism requires that we bear witness to the truth of how power imposes, oppresses, and deforms. Activism also requires that we name our vision for what education can be. We spoke with Sean Feeney about what really happens in schools that gets left out and distorted by value-added measures.
Now, I just spent some time walking around the school with you this morning, and you said hello to every single person we met. You clearly knew everyone. The degree to which relationships
matter
are really the foundation of teaching and learning and school communities that may or may not result in a 95 on the geometry regents for all the reasons that you've talked about earlier. How do we bring that discourse back into the conversations that we have about education? Because my experience is that I talk about it in my classroom, I see it in schools,
right,
but I don't hear it in the discourse about education.
Because you can't quantify it. How do you quantify, the principal knows folks? You can't. Listen, long after kids forget all that geometry that helped them get a 95, long after they forget the calculus or the fine points of Shakespearean tragedies, they're going to remember how you, as a teacher, made them feel in your class. That's the true inspiration behind teaching. Did you inspire them to become a learner and to pursue other areas? Did you inspire them to, challenge themselves upward and pursue their dreams? And yes, you do that in the context of teaching content, but the larger issue is how you're making them feel. And what this APPR is going to do is change those relationships irreparably. And we're already seeing it. We're getting comments from teachers. We're getting comments from principals who hear the discourse from one teacher to another. You need to stop going on field trips because that child can't be out of my class because his score is going to impact me. I don't care if it's a field trip to the art museum or whatever. I need that child in. Or, really, I already have two kids like that. I don't know if I can have another one. He's never comes to school. Why are you putting him in my class? He's an attendance problem. You don't like me? Is that why you're placing him in my class? You want my scores to go down? So rather than a student with an attendance issue or a migrant student, whatever it might be, you know, being placed and knowing that everybody was going to be supporting that kid, you know, the teacher's feeling the full weight of that child in his or her class. This is going to change the dynamics.
In the interest of naming the world we want, as we resist the one being imposed on us, we asked Karen Lewis what good teacher evaluations might look like.
I think that it would look extremely holistically. And one of the things it would do is allow teachers the time to really observe and look at other examples of really good teaching, and not through a photographic lens or, you know, a video lens. I think the idea of watching other people work and do the same thing that you do. I mean, I love the idea of lesson study, for example, and some kind of tailored version of that. I think it would be incredibly important to spend a lot of time on professional development. Again, my problem is we have standards and we have assessment, but we haven't worked out what's in between. And to me, the idea of providing all of our teachers with an opportunity to know what it is that good teaching looks like, to have the support to look like a good teacher and to be a good teacher, and then to have an observational and an objective instrument, which has yet to be created, by the way, regardless of what models that come down the pike. There's some that are better than others. But you're asking me to dream, right? That's where we're going. We're going with dreaming. That would also include an opportunity for an awful lot of feedback and refinement. And that, to me, would look like a good evaluation system.
This is Education Radio. In this final segment, we revisit parts of Diane Ravitch's keynote speech during the Save Our Schools conference that took place in Washington, D.C. in July 2011. Ravitch is an education historian and former neoliberal education reform insider. In this clip, she uses light humor as she names the underlying motives behind the imposition of teacher evaluations. Ravitch finishes with a call for collective action to save public education.
No Child Left Behind has been a bonanza for the testing companies. It's been a bonanza for people who sell you advice on how to do things. It's been a tragedy for the students and the teachers and the educators and families. Okay, so I'm almost loath to ask this question, but what do you think of Race to the Top? If you like NCLB, you'll love Race to the Top. Race to the Top takes all the assumptions of No Child Left Behind and doubles down. Just like NCLB, Race to the Top believes in carrots and sticks, rewards and punishments, and test scores is the ultimate goal of education. Race to the Top says if states want to win federal funding, they must award merit pay based on test scores. They must agree to close schools based on test scores, fire their staffs, turn them into charters based on test scores. They must agree to evaluate teachers based on test scores. Race to the Top, frankly, is wrong to use the metaphor of a race. American education is not a race to anywhere. American education is about equality of educational opportunity. That's not a race. By definition, a race has a few winners and a lot of losers. Our goal in education is not to pick winners, but to enable every child to prepare for a full and productive life in American society. Well, what do you think about this idea? It's very popular, evaluating teachers by test scores. This is one of the worst ideas ever. This is something that George W. Bush could have only dreamed of doing. It took a Democratic president to sell it. If scores go up over the course of a year, great teacher. If the scores are flat or they go down, bad teacher. You're not effective unless you can get those scores up. Testing experts warn that the methods used to calculate teacher quality by test scores are inaccurate and unstable. There are many factors that influence test scores, not just the teacher. Students are not randomly assigned. The same teacher may be at the top of the ratings 1 year and the bottom the next year, depending on the composition of his or her class. There's a large body of research that warns against using value-added assessment to rate teachers. I mean, if value-added assessment works, why wouldn't we look to Tennessee, which has been using it since 1988, as the number one state in the country? Anyone here from Tennessee? Number one state in the country? Not. And it's not because of the teachers, it's because that method doesn't work to raise anything except the number of people you can fire. And of course, if teachers are judged by test scores, they will be compelled to teach to the test, narrow the curriculum, and sadly, some will cheat. Well, where's the logic in any of this? Why should politicians design evaluation systems for teachers? What do they know about it? Nothing. Zero. Zip. How can they decide whether the test score should count for 50% or 12% or 92%? Why do they disregard all the experts who tell them that these methods don't work, that they're inaccurate and unstable? Why shouldn't the methods of evaluation for professionals be designed by professionals, not legislators? These people who call themselves reformers, who want to privatize our schools and destroy the education profession, have almost all the money and almost all the political power. But things change. Things change, and we should continue to make our voices heard. And one other thing about the reformers, they are few and we are many. So let's make this democracy work for the many, not the few. Let's save public education, save our children, and save our nation. Thank you.
This is Education Radio. I'm Tim Scott. You have been listening to education historian Diane Ravitch speaking at the Save Our Schools Conference in Washington, D.C. during July 2011. In this week's program, we have looked at the attempt by education reformers to impose value-added measures on teacher evaluation as an example of how neoliberal forces have used the economic crisis to blackmail schools into practices that do not serve teaching and learning, but do serve the corporate profiteers as they work to privatize public education and limit the goals of education to vocational training for corporate hegemony. These processes constrict possibilities for educational experiences that are critical, relational, and transformative. We have seen, however, that in naming these processes and taking risks both individually and collectively, we can begin to speak back to and overcome these forces. In next week's show, we will continue to examine the process of neoliberalism as it uses audit culture to undermine teaching and learning for democracy in its manifestation in teacher education, where the discourse of accountability and data-driven decisions is poisoning the possibilities for how we educate our teachers. Education Radio is produced by the Education Radio Collective. Find us at education-radio.blogspot.com. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter.